This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Basketball is more than a game to many young men in the inner city. It's the ticket to a better future. For some young men, a basketball scholarship may provide the only shot at a college education and a decent job. Added to that, of course, is the chance to play in front of millions of ESPN viewers and the possibility of making it to the NBA. Basketball offers hope, but to many young men, it's a false hope. My guest, Darcy Frey, is the author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. He spent a year following four players on the basketball team of Lincoln High in Coney Island. This part of Brooklyn, which was famous for its amusement park, is now a neighborhood Frey describes as having almost no stores, no trees, no police, nothing but block after block of gray cement housing projects. Frey says there are no jobs. Simply put, there is basketball, and when that doesn't work, there are drugs.
These kids have come from such uniformly impoverished circumstances and poor educational backgrounds that the chance that's dangled in front of them to win a college scholarship, get a four-year degree, and hopefully a decent job afterwards is really the only way out. These kids, you know, their educational backgrounds are so bad that they're scoring something like, you know, a combined 700 on the SATs. They've got pretty low grade point averages, and if it weren't for the idea of a basketball scholarship, they wouldn't be going to college, and they'd be sort of rooting around in the neighborhood for the rest of their lives, like so many of their older brothers and older friends.
So basketball means more than just the opportunity to play, the dream of playing in the NBA. It's a ticket to college.
Yeah, exactly. I think we have this idea that there are all these inner city kids out there, and they're all deluded into thinking that they're going to win multi-million dollar contracts in the NBA. The kids that I wrote about were actually quite coldly realistic in their appraisal of their options in life, and one of the things they wanted to do was use their aptitude and skill at basketball to get to a four-year school and get a bachelor's degree, and even that was out of reach for a lot of the kids.
What are the courts like in Coney Island where the kids you wrote about play on?
Well, Coney Island now, I mean, there is this I think it's we have this historical notion that it's still, you know, boardwalk, amusement park, the beach, but the residential area of Coney Island is a 30 square block area devoted to almost nothing but housing projects, vacant lots, and basketball courts sort of nestled in between the buildings. And the kids that I wrote about play at a neighborhood court that they've called the Garden, after Madison Square Garden. And it's really where the most disciplined and aspiring players go to play. And it's really, you go there and you think you're going to watch a sort of normal playground pickup game, and what you see is this incredibly intense discipline five-on-five contest with coaches and drills and sometimes referees brought in to officiate the games. It's really quite a sight.
So the kids who you were writing about were trying to perfect their basketball skills to get to college, but they also had to try to improve their academic record to get that basketball scholarship.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, actually, one of the things that basketball does is it does provide this carrot that inspires kids who might not otherwise take their academics that seriously to hit the books because they want to remain eligible in college. But one of the interesting things I found out, the hero of my story is this kid named Russell Thomas, who was as devoted to his schoolwork as he was to basketball. He used to, at the end of every practice, he'd go home with a stack of SAT review books, vocabulary, flashcards. He was studying like crazy to pass these tests and to try to keep himself eligible. And actually, one of the very sad things about reporting this book was watching him in his senior year struggling over and over again with a standardized test that made him increasingly demoralized.
Why was it so hard for him to prepare for the SATs?
Well, the SAT, the standard that the NCAA has set for incoming college athletes is a combined score of 700, which doesn't seem on the outset, or it didn't to me, as a terribly rigorous standard. But these kids are coming from years and years of poor educations. And then by the time they become seniors in high school, they're sitting down to answer algebra and reading comprehension questions on the SATs when they've barely learned the fundamentals of multiplication or even finished a book. And they're coming to it with none of the advantages that suburban kids, say, who have taken Stanley Kaplan review courses have had. And one of the other things, Russell Thomas had nerves of steel on the court. He could not be fazed, even if the game was on the line. When he sat down in front of the SATs, knowing how much was at stake, he would panic, and he just couldn't perform.
You give some statistics in your book, and you say that after Proposition 48 was put into effect by the NCAA, requiring the 700 SAT point average, that 91% of the kids who became ineligible for college basketball were black.
That's right, and they're sort of grimly referred to as Prop 48 casualties. 91% since the rule had been set up in 1986 have been black, 9% have been white. There's an incredible racial, cultural divide. I had a real sort of, critics of the standardized tests have been complaining for years that they're culturally biased, and I had a very specific idea of what that meant after spending 8 or 9 months with the kids on the team and watching them struggle with the test. I actually opened it up and took a look at it, and my eye lit on a verbal question that said, name a synonym for panache. And it just sort of hit me. How is a kid, having grown up all his life in that projects in Coney Island, going to know the answer to that?
The funny thing is that these are kids who display panache on the court, but they wouldn't wouldn't necessarily know the word for it.
That's right, and they're quick, they're bright, they're just not prepared for such things. But they're poorly schooled, and that's the dilemma.
Journalist Darcy Frey is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Last Shot: City Streets, Basketball Dreams. You went to a Nike summer camp with one of the players who you write about. This is their ABCD program, which stands for Academic Betterment and Career Development Program.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what this Nike camp was like.
Well, the Nike shoe company bills this as a sort of fresh air camp for inner city kids where they'll brush up on their schoolwork and play a little bit of basketball. What it really is a week-long jamboree where Nike invites the 120 top high school basketball players in the country to play in Indianapolis every summer with plane fare, hotel, food, shirts, shorts, sneakers, all paid in full by Nike, which is an astonishing amount of largesse that gets passed on to the kids. That would be a blatantly illegal inducement if it actually came from a college coach, but the NCAA has no jurisdiction over the sneaker companies. The camp is basically games all day long where the players, almost all of them black, run back and forth on three separate courts in front of bleachers filled with college, Division I college coaches, almost all of them white, watching the kids, appraising them, and basically scrutinizing every physical attribute of the players. And a number of analogies have been drawn, and probably the most charitable one that I saw actually appeared as a headline in the Indianapolis News the week that I was out there. It said, "Camp resembles State Fair cattle exhibition." It really is a meat market.
Now, there is some time for academic work at the camp. There's math and English classes through the morning.
That's right. And to some degree, it's better teaching and more attention than some of the kids have ever seen in high school. But it does the kids good. But there's a serious profit motive that goes on with the camp, and the reason why the shoe company stages it. A number of years ago, Nike began signing up all the top college coaches to exclusive endorsement contracts, which meant that if you were a coach in the Big East, say at Seton Hall or Villanova, if you signed with Nike and you got a nice six-figure annual stipend from the shoe company, you had to make sure that your players were wearing Nike sneakers. And this, you know, basically the kids became walking billboards for the sneaker companies. The Nike camp is a sort of extension of this marketing strategy. It allows Nike to reach ever deeper into the game, to bring even the best high school players into the corporate fold, so that a kid who's a star athlete will go to a high school team sponsored by Nike, help spend his summers at a summer camp sponsored by Nike, and then in all likelihood he'll sign with a college sponsored by Nike. And if he becomes the next NBA superstar, the next Michael Jordan or David Robinson, he's most likely going to sign his exclusive endorsement contract with Nike.
You went to this Nike summer camp with one of the students you were following named Chaka.
Mm-hmm.
What was the experience like for him?
Enormous pressure. I think that we have this idea that that these kids are getting almost a free ride, and that the recruiting and the exposure the lavishness of it all just goes to a kid's head, and the greatest casualty is if a player gets a big head. These kids are under enormous pressure, and Chaka felt it during the week that he was out there. Here's a 17-year-old kid who has to face pressures and perform in a fashion that most of us never have to in our lives, and he's got to do it at a time when there's so little for him to fall back on if his dream of using basketball to get to college doesn't work out.
Well, he became the first player at Lincoln High ever to attract the interest of all the schools in the Big East Conference. And you were with him as some of the coaches came to his high school to try to talk him into signing up. Tell us a little bit about the strategies different coaches used to convince him to join their team.
For most of the fall of the year that I spent with the team, every Big East coach, as he said, came in. Raleigh Massimino, who was then of Villanova, Jim Boeheim of Syracuse, P.J. Carlesimo, then of Seton Hall. They all come in with a different pitch. Jim Boeheim promised Chaka he would have a starting position as a freshman. That was his way of romancing Chaka. Chaka and his friends all had a suspicion about Jim Boeheim. Boeheim has a reputation on the street as for recruiting over, which means signing up an athlete and then giving his starting spot to a better athlete if one should come along. So Chaka was vaguely suspicious of Jim Boeheim. Raleigh Massimino came in and promised Chaka that if he signed with Villanova, he would be part of a warm and loving family, that Chaka and Massimino would be lifelong friends. There was something that made Chaka suspicious of that pitch as well, and it turned out to be well-founded, because the next year Massimino jumped ship and started coaching at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. The coaches come in with all sorts of promises. If a kid signs with a college, he has got to go to that college. He must honor his commitment to go to the college. But there are no NCAA rules that bind the coaches similarly to make them honor their commitments to the kids.
Do you think that a lot of players choose a college based on which sneaker company has an endorsement contract with the coach there?
I met a kid actually at the Nike camp who had been in the Nike system since he was basically in fifth grade. He had played on Nike teams throughout his prep school career. And he told me once, I want to go to a Nike college, because if I go to Providence, I got to wear Converse. If I go to Villanova, I got to wear LA gear. So I'm going to go to one of the Nike colleges. And it's easy to laugh at that, but this is just adolescent, interest in fashion, except in this case, the colleges and the sneaker companies are in line to profit greatly from a sort of adolescent decision like that.
Chaka signed with Seton Hall. What happened to him there?
P.J. Carlesimo came in, recruited him. One of the reasons why Chaka signed with Seton Hall was that he was promised ample playing time, chance to play at small forward, where Chaka thought his skills would really shine. After 2 years at Seton Hall, Chaka had averaged only 3 minutes a game. He was being used as a backup center. And ultimately, I think that he felt that he had been lied to by the coaches there as much as the coaches that he decided not to sign with. And he decided to transfer after 2 years to the University of California at Irvine, a lower-level school where he thought he might get a chance to start. A terrible thing happened to Chaka just this past summer, though, when he was going out to California to start his career out there. He got into an awful car accident, which has kept him off the team this year. And I think it's up in the air whether the schools are going to honor the scholarship, even though he can't play ball.
And if a school doesn't honor the scholarship, he's out of college.
Unless he can find another way to fund his college education. You know, even the kids who sign on to Division I schools have a really hard time making it through. They're spending 25, 35 hours a week traveling to games and practices, so they fall behind in their schoolwork. And then fewer than half of Division I athletes will graduate in less than 5 years. Though they only have 4 years of athletic eligibility, often their scholarships run out and they're left, either they have to drop out without a degree or they have to find some other way to fund the rest of their schooling. I think one of the things the NCAA ought to consider is if a kid plays 4 good years on a team, that kid should be able to stay in college as long as it takes him to earn his degree. He's made money by virtue of ticket sales and television contracts for that school, and that school still has an obligation to the kid so that he can get an education.
My guest is journalist Darcy Frey, author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Darcy Frey, author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. You write in your book that many people think of basketball scholarships as the black version of the American dream, but you've reached the conclusion that it's really a cruel parody of the American dream.
You know, yeah, I did think it was the sort of black version of the American dream when I started out. In the classic parable of the American dream, you know, you start out with nothing and you slowly accrue your riches through hard work in a system that's designed to help those who help themselves. Here, in this system, you start out at the age of 16, 17 years old with one narrow, treacherous path that's really strewn with all sorts of obstacles that merely reminds you of how little you have. You've got recruiters passing themselves off as father figures. You've got standardized tests that are humiliating if you've come from a disadvantaged educational background. You've got the promise of these multi-million-dollar NBA contracts that ultimately reminds you of what it feels like to go through life with nothing in this world. And so I think it is a cruel hoax that's played on these kids.
And yet, I mean, some of the kids who you wrote about are really much better off because of basketball scholarships.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Scholarships and basketball offers kids exposure. It gives them motivation to study. For the very few, like Chaka, they end up getting a Division I college scholarship. But they are in peril of being exploited every step of the way. And the exploitation begins much earlier than just late high school and college. These kids, the star athletes in New York City and elsewhere, are recruited from the time they're in fifth grade by the junior high schools, the high schools, the summer camps, the summer leagues. You know, basketball for these kids is a year-round activity, and every month of the year there's a different coach who wants a piece of these kids.
How do you think the system could be changed so that the kids aren't exploited but still have opportunities?
Well, I think as long as big-time college basketball is going to be grafted onto our system of higher education, then such things as Prop 48, which puts a lot of personal responsibility on the kids to hit the books and get good SAT scores, is fine. But the high schools and the colleges, the institutions themselves, have to be equally committed to educating these players. And there are all sorts of things the NCAA could consider doing besides eligibility requirements for the players that they never do, which would put responsibility on the colleges. For instance, they could ban freshman eligibility in college across the board. So every player's first year in school is devoted entirely to schoolwork and academics. But, you know, there's a lot of money that comes into the schools if they recruit top high school freshmen. So the NCAA never considers that. Another thing they could consider doing is denying schools their coveted Division I status if their players don't graduate. But again, that's something that, you know, the colleges will lose their Division I status. They won't get their television contracts. And those choices that the NCAA could make but don't make, I think, puts the lie to the idea that they really care as much about academics as they do about athletics. In high school and in college, on both levels, academics has really become the subset to sports, not the other way around.
Why shouldn't a gifted athlete be recognized for their athletic achievement without the burden of achieving a good academic standing?
You know, if academics and athletics are going to be separated, and college basketball is going to be seen as a big business, which in fact it is, you know, the Big East Conference got $65 million for a 1-year contract with CBS Sports. If it's going to be commerce pure and simple, then these players should be called professionals, which is what they are, and they should be paid. And the NCAA should not use their amateur status guidelines to keep the players from getting paid. I actually think that players ought to receive some sort of stipend for the services that they render to their teams on the court.
I'm interested in talking to you about an ethical dilemma that you were in the middle of. You had told the families of the young men that you were writing about that you would share the book's profits with them.
That's right. Actually, one of the parents of the players said that if he were to cooperate with my reporting efforts, I had to pay him. And at first, I just said, no, I can't do that. That's, you know, reporters can't pay people for information. That's checkbook journalism. That's what the National Enquirer does. Over time, though, when we went back and forth with negotiations over a period of months, I realized that my book was becoming more and more about how these kids were getting exploited by the system of college athletics. And I didn't want to put myself in the same exploitative relationship with the families. And I actually decided that I would share whatever profit the book might make with the families of the principal players in the book. The NCAA stepped in, though, at that point and said that the kids would lose their amateur status and it would jeopardize their eligibility to play college basketball. And so the deal fell through.
One of the parents decided not to talk with you anymore, not to let his son talk with you anymore, after he could no longer share in the profits from the book.
That's right. There was the father of one player who wanted some compensation. The mother of another player her son's recruiting was sort of hanging in the balance, and she felt that anybody, whether it was a reporter like me or actually even her son's girlfriend, who she persuaded him to break up with, anyone who was going to distract him in any fashion from this tenuous passage out of poverty that he was on was going to be a threat to him. And so she told her son not to talk to me anymore. In fact, when these two things happened and when the NCAA banned me from the college campuses, I actually thought that my book had fallen apart. And after several months of trying to figure out what to do with this material, I decided, in fact, it was going to be a third-person book, a sort of omnisciently narrated book. I decided to put some of those obstacles that I encountered as a reporter in the book, write it in the first person, because I thought that the things that I encountered were some of the most illuminating and revealing things that I learned about the situation the kids themselves were in, the desperate need for money, the suspicion of anyone who might exploit them, and the great hypocrisy of NCAA rules that prevent these kids from profiting in any fashion from their skill.
Well, Darcy Frey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Darcy Frey is the author of The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. He's a contributing editor at Harper's and the New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.